Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age."
Well, Matthew 28, 18 through 20, really 16 through 20. 18 through 20 is considered what we call a great commission by most people, but a couple of verses before that have some really important things in them that I want to point out along the way. So thank you, Connie, for reading that whole section there. Well, some years ago, I remember me and my father were out in the backyard, and there was this tree that really had begun to look more like a bush of sorts, and to die and wilt. It had been overcome with weeds. Vines were growing up it, and it was in rough shape. But of course, it was on our property, and we didn't really feel it. The thing we wanted to do to just chop it down and burn it or whatever. So we went out and said, "Well, let's see what we can do with this thing." So trimmed out some of the things that were growing around the trunk there, and we trimmed off the vines and began pruning the tree. Well, as many of you know, this September we went to North Carolina for a little bit of a vacation. And while we were there, my mom put together a family party, if you will, invited the relatives so we could see some people that we hadn't seen in quite a while. And she called a photographer to come out there to take pictures. We didn't know if maybe this would be the last time they would see each other. Some of the folks there are quite elderly, and we thought maybe this would be a good time to take some pictures. But this photographer, as she scanned the backyard, would you know the spot that she picked to have our pictures taken? It was in front of this tree that some years ago was wilting and dying. It had become a tree that was flourishing. In fact, it had red foliage. It was quite beautiful, almost a deep cherry red color had come about on many of the leaves. And the once thought to be dead tree had become a vibrant, living, flourishing organism that provided the spot for not only shade, but for beautiful pictures with family. Growth was the natural result of health. We removed the things that were preventing health for this tree, and it began to flourish and it began to grow. Well, the same is true of churches. In a similar way, churches are organisms, and Jesus likened the church to a vine with branches. He said, "I am the vine and you are the branches," in John 15. And like many plants, there is a real need for pruning and trimming from time to time. There is a real need to tend to the plant, to not necessarily let it go as it will, but to enter in and to help it if maybe disease or other plants are attacking it. If an organism is going to thrive and be healthy, then we must be mindful of these things. Well, what are some of the dangers posed to the church? One of them, one of the greatest dangers, I really think, that exists for any church, maybe a weed, if you will, maybe a disease or an illness that we need to be on the lookout for, is a lack of vision or purpose. Or maybe the wrong vision or purpose. It's absolutely crucial for any individual to thrive. There's maybe some of you who have dealt with depression from time to time. There's a sense of purposelessness and futility to everything. Why do I get out of bed in the morning? Why do I want to go about my day? What difference does it make? For many depressed people, you know how real lack of purpose can be and how deadly. But let alone a group. If a group lacks purpose, then it will not be able to maximize its potential to be healthy and thrive. It needs a clear-cut vision and purpose. Well, let me put the question to you then. Why are we here? Why are you folks here this morning? Why, as pastor of this church, why do I take the time to do this? Is this just 40 hours a week for me? It's really a lot more than that, but is it just something for me to do to kind of kill some time and make ends meet? Or is there something deeper? Why are you folks here? Why does this church exist? Why did whoever put this building in place and established this institution, why did they do it some 150, 200 years ago? What's the purpose? What is our role in the world? Well, many answers have been provided to what the purpose of the church is. And I want to just, these are a few off the cuff here that I feel are maybe somewhat popular in our culture. One of them, people think of the church as a big crutch. It exists to prop up those who otherwise would have little hope or little purpose in their life. Karl Marx was a popular German economist who said that religion is the opium of the people. In essence, Marx was saying that there's this illusion that's created by religion that gives some people hope. The poor, who otherwise would have no hope, can have some hope because there's this place called the church that gives them this false hope, false illusion of a life to come and eternal bliss. So that was his understanding of the role the church played in society. Maybe for some, the church is a social club, like a big extracurricular activity to kill the boredom. Maybe the monotony of weekends. You go to church and you see a few people and you talk about what's going on in town. Maybe for some, church is the place they look to get a hot date or they play bingo, whatever. It's a place to be social. For some today, the church is the hub of political activism. It's a place you go to make an impact politically. Maybe some of you know, but our president was a member of a very infamous now, I guess, in many respects, United Church of Christ. We're a UCC church as well in Chicago that was sort of renowned for their activism and their political opinions and thoughts on things. And I myself, in training to become ordained, participated in some churches that are very frequently on the way out the door. They would have a couple of tables in the back. They would have pre-printed letters for you to sign and mail off to your representatives about issues like war and fracking and other things. Well, these people understood the church to be the purpose of the church, to make a political impact. Justice was really what it's all about for these folks. Maybe others think of the church as a business or it's a place of philanthropy. You know, our business, our profit may not be in dollars. It's in encouraging people to live a moral life, to promote proper behavior in our community. Or it looks good on our resume. It kind of gets us some brownie points with possible employers. Yeah, I went there for a few years kind of thing. It's the place to go if you want to give back or do some volunteering. Maybe some groups think of the church strictly in terms of the organization itself. For some, the church becomes its own end. The goal of the church is to get people in church. And that's really what it's about. And then for some, it's just a building. Brick, mortar, and stone. Maybe nothing more. Its purpose is just to be a meeting place. And that's what the church is. Maybe this describes some of y'all's views on the church. I know they are very popular in many respects in our culture. But what is the right view of the church? What really is the purpose of the church? What's the goal? What's the mission? Well, who founded the church? Jesus, right? So we probably should go ask Jesus. Let's see what Jesus has to say about the purpose of the church. And when Jesus describes the church as being like a vine and branches that are plugged into Him, He's saying something fundamentally different than what all of these other things are saying. He's saying that the church is a living organism. And as we just heard in our text that we read here in Matthew 28, I want to sort of draw out of that what Jesus describes, I believe, to be very clearly the purpose, the goal of the church as a body of people, as an organism that exists and founded by Christ. He's given it this mission, and I want to talk a little bit about that this morning. I won't reread the passage, but if you just look at it there, almost grammatically right in the center, if you just look right in the heart, core, center of this passage, and not just physically in the middle of the paragraph, but also logically, the very center of this passage is the phrase, make disciples. That's the heart and soul. That's what's at the core of this mission, to go, therefore, and make disciples. This is the great purpose and work of the church. This is the great calling that we have and the great task given to us by God. This should probably be a verse that we all have memorized. Should probably be one that we think about on a daily basis. This is what it's all about. Well, to really understand this purpose that Jesus has given us in the Great Commission, let's make a few observations right off the bat. First of all, let's give attention to the timing of this commission. When does Jesus say this? Matthew 28, right at the end of the chapter, right? It's literally at the very, very end of the book. And, you know, you'll find in all the Gospels where the Great Commission is mentioned, it's near the end. We sense from the account that Jesus has died, He's risen, and maybe He's about to rise, right? We get the sense that maybe this is right before He's saying, in essence, I'm gonna go, and this is what I'm giving to you to do now. And so right before Jesus leaves, in essence, He gives us this command, these famous last words. And we put a lot of emphasis, do we not, on human people and their last words. We think of maybe the famous last words of someone like Nelson Mandela, or we listen to the words of, we recently studied the Reformation, Martin Luther, guys like that. We wonder, what did these people say in their dying breath? What was on their heart and their mind? Of course, Jesus wasn't dying, but you get what I'm saying. These are very important words. One thing Jesus wanted to leave with us before He left, and He gave us this. We should pay attention to it. One scholar writes this, "We might say that this passage is of such fundamental significance that something should be said about each word." We could take each word or each little collection of words and analyze them and go into detail about the meaning of this passage. But the point is, we must pay special attention to what Jesus is saying here. So notice the timing. That's the first big thing. It's right at the end. That's a big deal. That's an observation. Second observation let's make. Notice the word therefore. Right in the front of verse 19, He says, "Therefore go," or in some translations, "go therefore." Anytime you see that word, this is a goofy cliche, but I'm going to use it. You see the word therefore, you need to try and figure out what it's there for. I mean, you've probably heard that a lot. But you need to look before and after it and see why. What is it saying? What's He getting at here? And if you look before it, here's what you see. Jesus says this, verse 18, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to Me." He says in verse 18, well, then you ask, okay, for making observations of the text and trying to get to the meat, what does this mean? Okay, for what? What authority? Why? What's the point of this authority? Why is Jesus saying that? Who gave it to Him? Why has all this authority been given to Jesus? So we ask these questions. And to answer this question, I want to point us quickly to Philippians chapter 2. If you want to flip there, that's great. You can do that. But beginning with verse 6. The essence of it, I won't read the whole thing, but it says this. He says, "Who," that is Jesus, "being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped or to His own advantage. He made Himself nothing. He humbled Himself to the point of death on a cross. He was obedient to the Father." And then here comes these words, 9. "Therefore, God exalted Him to the highest place and gave Him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth." It says God gave Him the authority. So the Father, right, who sent Jesus, gave Him this authority that is now His. And that makes sense because He's God. God has that authority to give. But why did He give it to Him? God gave Him all the authority because He was worthy. Because He did exactly what God gave Him to do. He was faithful. Without flaw, without failure, without compromise, without sin, Jesus accomplished everything His Father sent Him to do. Therefore, all authority was given to Jesus. The implication seems to be this, because right after that He says, "Therefore go." All authority is given to Me, therefore go. What seems to be the implication of that? What's the logic there? It seems to be that one of the overarching purposes of Christ's work on earth was not just to die and to save His disciples or that immediate group of people that He knew on earth, but it was so that He could send them to go. So He died, He rose, He did all that, saved his people, and because I have authority, you are now to go. Something bigger, the plan was bigger than just Israel, than just these few disciples. Maybe Jesus knew that we would be tempted to huddle up in a little group like a fraternity, or to huddle up in a corner and say, and be amongst ourselves. And in fact, that's what you see, is it not? In Acts, for those of you all who are familiar with it, they huddle up and they kind of stay to themselves and they're afraid until the Holy Spirit falls upon them, and then they're given power and they fulfill, go out and do what Jesus asked of them. But Jesus, maybe he says this because he knows we're going to be tempted to just huddle up and be to ourselves. And he says, no, you need to go. You need to go to that uncomfortable place and share me with others. The third observation I want to make about the text is this, is the phrase make disciples. And I've already pointed this out a little bit, but I want to reference it again. You'll notice that this is the key phrase in the whole thing. It holds it all together. So why are we going? He says, go. Well, we're going to make disciples. Where are we going to make disciples? All the nations. What does this entail? Well, baptize them and teach them. How are we to do this? I am with you always to the end of the age. It's all about making disciples. The whole text revolves around that phrase. The Great Commission is about making disciples. Okay, Pastor, I'm sensing what you're saying here. We've made a few observations. This is all well and good and interesting. But what does it all mean? What exactly can you put this together, maybe in a bigger picture for me here? What does it mean? Well, I want to give you two or three things here that it means for you right now. And then I'm going to try and, or that it means, we're going to interpret this and then we'll apply it. The first one is this, that what I mentioned in the intro, if you were here, disciples make disciples. At its root, what this means is that an essential part of being a disciple is making disciples. Do you see that? The same word is used of the 11 in the first verse there. It says the 11 gathered because Judas had gone and hung himself for what he did, the guilt and the shame of all of that. He went and he did that. So there's only 11 remaining, but the 11 disciples are told to go and make disciples. They're called to duplicate themselves. It's the same word. It's the apostles, the disciples, are now making more disciples. If you are a disciple, then you will be about making disciples. May look a bit different for you and for me, how it's applied, what exactly it looks like, but you will be about making disciples. Maybe you could think of an illustration to help get my point across here. Think of a barge. I don't know if you've ever been to a port city. I used to live in Charleston, South Carolina, which was a major port city in the south, in the southern part of the state. And they had these huge, large ships, these barges that would come in and out constantly. And were loaded up and they would go and they would bring cargo. And one thing you see if you sit out there and watch these barges is that they can't steer worth a rip. You know, they take several miles to turn around, right? So what do? They have little tugboats. These little boats that'll go and push on one part of the ship or another part of the ship to turn it. You know, but one tugboat might be pushing, say the barge is this great commission that we're all a part of. Well, one tugboat might be pushing on the front one way, the other one's pushing in the back another way to kind of get the boat to go where it needs to go. The point is they're about the same business, they're about the same goal. Get the barge into port here so we can unload it and reload it. But it looks a little different. One might be accelerating a little bit more. One might be braking. One might be using its winch. One might be pushing it or nudging it. But they have the same end goal in mind. The second thing that this means for us. So the first thing, disciples, a part of being a disciple is making disciples. The second thing is that making disciples is about all of life. It's not about maybe what we think going into like a classroom setting. We think maybe of being trained. But actually, in the ancient world, they would have had a very different understanding of what it meant to study, to learn, to be a disciple. In fact, the word disciple, the idea that it's communicating is a learner, a pupil, a student. And in the ancient world, they would have thought of learning and of being a pupil and a disciple as an all-of-life event. Notice that when Jesus called the disciples, he didn't say, hey, I'm going to be holding a class over at the place next to the temple down there. If y'all want to show up once a week, I'll give you some sense about what the truth is and who I am and all that. No, he said, follow me. They went in the boats together. They ate and drank together. They went and spent time with people together. They went everywhere. So it's an all of life event. So I want us to get that sense about discipleship too. Instruction and truth, of course. I'm not saying that somehow it's just all practical stuff. There is a doctrinal and a propositional truth side to things where there's teaching, there's verbal communication going on. It's not just hanging out with Jesus, so to speak, but it's not just the classroom kind of thing either. It's everything. Look in verse 20. I want you to see that. What is it that Jesus gives them to do in this commission? Part of it is to teach them everything, right? How to obey all my commands. And this includes even the unpopular truths maybe that get left out in today's pop culture Christianity. Jesus didn't say, just teach the main thing, whatever that is. Yeah, you want to focus on the main thing, right? The main thing is the main thing. But Jesus didn't say, you know, you cut this part out or that. I wasn't doing well that day. You know, I had a little bit, you know, so just ignore that part of what I was saying. No, he says everything, right? Teach all things to obey everything. But the point I'm trying to get at again is that this was no casual or willy-nilly relationship. This was everything. These disciples followed Jesus. Some of them left their day jobs to be with Jesus. Jesus had died for these men and these women. If you follow a man like that, you're probably pretty serious about it, you know? It wasn't a willy-nilly casual thing. And what's weird about it, I don't know if you all have sensed this in our culture here in America, is that people who are too serious about their faith, if you get a little too serious about Jesus, then suddenly you get some labels. Oh, you're a radical. You're an extremist. You're a fundamentalist. You're a little bit too into that stuff, too into the Bible, too into Jesus. And I find that really odd because our culture encourages us on the major things, the most important things, your faith, your religion, your belief system, what you believe about the world, what is true, what is right and wrong. It says, pursue moderation with that stuff. Don't get too serious about that stuff. Be somewhere in the middle on those things. But when it comes to sex and drink and alcohol and party and self-indulgence, go all out, you know. Pursue it like it's everything, really. Our culture has this very, very backwards, I think. But the way the early church viewed being a disciple and making disciples was that there was no moderation. You were in it or you weren't in it. You went after it with all your heart or you didn't go after it at all. The third thing I want us to see, what this means for us, or what this means, is that everyone is called to go. Jesus says, go therefore. You'll notice that there are some, and I'm going to comment a little bit more on this in a minute, there are some in here who doubted. You'll see in verse 17, I think it is, it says they worship Jesus, but some of them doubted. Is that not interesting? That Jesus gave the command to all of them, even if maybe they had some doubts, even if they were struggling with some things. What you'll also see too that's really interesting is that Jesus didn't go up to say, Peter on the side, and give Peter one mission and say, hey Peter, this is what I want you to do, brother. If you'll take this and go over here into this part of the world. All right, see you, man. Go ahead. All right, now I'm going to come meet with Thomas over here and I'm going to tell Thomas and give him a vision. Okay, Thomas, you go do that. All right, now I'm going to meet with Matthew and give him something else to do. No, he called them all together. All the disciples were there and he gave them the same